The president reaches a deal with Republicans on tax cuts.
Now let's put the politics aside and focus on the economics.
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From American Public Media, hello, I'm Jeremy Hobson in New York.
And I'm Steve Chiotakis in Los Angeles. You're listening to the Midday Update from Marketplace.org. Today is Tuesday, December 7th. Coming up, a look at cities around the world before and after the Great Recession. Also, the nation's oldest institution of higher learning makes a big change in leadership after a big drop in its endowment. Wait till you hear why.
But first, to our top story, President Obama has reached a deal with Republicans to extend the Bush tax cuts that were set to expire this month. If the deal survives its trip through Congress, the cuts will be extended for all income levels for 2 years.
In exchange, the president will get some of what he wanted, an extension of unemployment benefits for 13 months and a 1-year cut in the amount of taxes workers pay into the Social Security Fund.
For more on all this, let's bring in Diane Lim Rogers. She's chief economist at the Concord Coalition. Good morning.
Good morning, Jeremy.
So let's start with what this means for individuals. What do you think?
Well, it means all American individuals are going to see pretty substantial tax cuts in the coming year. They get some continuation of the Bush tax cuts. They get a payroll tax holiday of 2% of their income. And those who are unemployed will continue to receive unemployment benefits. So a lot of tax cuts and a lot of help will be coming from the federal government.
A lot of tax cuts for individuals. Some are already calling this a second stimulus package. What does it mean for our economy?
It is another boost to stimulus. I've seen an estimate that the package is going to cost about $700 billion a year. We seem to like that figure. Our stimulus has been that size before, so it is like a second round of stimulus. I think it would have been better if we had swapped some of the elements of the Bush tax cuts that were less effective for these new elements that are more effective, but it is going to be a helpful boost to the economy, certainly in the short term.
And it's obviously going to mean a lot less revenue coming into the federal government. Quickly, Diane, what does it mean for the deficit?
Well, it means we're obviously adding hundreds of billions of dollars more in debt. We've deficit financed this package, or that's the plan. And so we're going to need to, in the next couple years before this round of the Bush tax cuts expire, we're going to need to find more fundamental tax reform to replace the current system, and we're going to need to find a way to raise more revenue.
All right, Diane Lim Rogers, chief economist at the Concord Coalition. Thanks so much for your time this morning.
Thank you.
Now let's get another take on this story from David Leonhardt, economics columnist at the New York Times, who's calling this plan a second stimulus. David, good morning.
Good morning.
How much of a stimulus program would this be? What's the price tag?
Now, most people think that ultimately they were going to extend, at the very least, the Bush tax cuts for people under 250. In fact, most people think they were always going to extend all of them because of the political hand that the Republicans held. So basically, I think you're left with $300 billion in stimulus that before we heard this deal, we weren't sure we were going to get. And that's a combination of tax cuts, unemployment insurance, and tax cuts for businesses.
The unofficial definition, David, of stimulus is some sort of program that puts money into the economy immediately. How is this supposed stimulus, as you call it, going to do that?
The advantage of a stimulus program like this is that it actually does get spent quite quickly. You start sending out new unemployment checks. You start cutting people's taxes. It happens very quickly. The disadvantage is that some amount of the money will get saved. The unemployment benefits are probably not going to get saved because people who are unemployed need that money. But other people will get their tax cuts, and they may well decide, you know what, I'm going to spend half of this, or I'm going to spend two-thirds of it. And the money that goes into their bank account really will not be stimulus.
If this is a stimulus, David, why don't Democratic leaders just call it that and claim some sort of victory? I mean, they feel, you know, very defeated right now. So they could come out and say, hey, well, this really is kind of a stimulus program. It sort of worked in our favor, and we champion the middle class.
Well, stimulus has become something of a dirty word politically. It is not economically. I mean, the Congressional Budget Office, Ben Bernanke, the chairman of the Fed, who's a Republican, all the private firms that have looked at it, all say that the stimulus program made a huge difference. But politically, it's very hard to split hairs and say, yes, but things would have been even worse without the bill. And so Democrats have decided they don't like the word stimulus. They are going to instead talk about this as a jobs bill. But economically speaking, there's no difference between stimulus and jobs.
David Leonhardt from the New York Times. David, thanks.
Thank you.
Taxpayers own a lot less of Citigroup today, one of the banks that got the most bailout money during the financial crisis. The Treasury Department sold the last of its common shares yesterday. And as Marketplace's David Gura reports, the government came out on top.
The U.S. government has effectively closed the book on one of the biggest parts of the Wall Street bailout. Last night, the government offloaded the last of its common shares of Citigroup stock. Bank analyst Bert Ely says that's good news.
I think the message is, while there are enormous reservations about the wisdom of the government having to have done it in the first place, at least it did not turn out to be a loser for taxpayers.
Hardly. In total, the government will make $12 billion on its investment in Citigroup with this sale. It's been a continuing process over the last few months. The Treasury Department has scaled back its ownership stake in several large banks, automakers, and other companies. After the sale, Citigroup can also say it's moving on. In Washington, I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
You know the routine. You're late for work. Jeremy, you probably know this, getting on an elevator. You're waiting for the door to close. No one else is coming, right? You look around to make sure you don't want to be rude, right, and let the doors close on somebody. But the door is still open, and nobody's coming. And so you hit that button, the door close button. You've seen it, right?
Yeah, like a million times you hit that button.
Exactly. Well, the folks at the PBS program Nova examined whether those buttons, the closed door button, even works. Some engineers say they do work in some cases. But the surprising thing is others claim the button is a sham and is only there to lift passengers' spirits. You know,
I'm in that camp.
Make them feel like they're doing something proactive. So listening to the Midday Update for Tuesday, December 7th. I'm Steve Chiatakis in Los Angeles.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson in New York. We're going to get a take now on the global perspective, what's happening in business and economics around the world, and how it affects us here in the United States.
The company that owned the oil rig, which exploded in the Gulf of Mexico, leading to the big BP oil disaster, had a near miss in Europe just 4 months earlier. From London, the BBC's John Bithrie looks at a leaked report.
The report details an incident last December on a rig off the British coast. This time, the rig wasn't owned by BP. Instead, it was a Shell oil facility. But the rig was operated by the same company as in the Gulf of Mexico, Transocean. The report says engineers may have misinterpreted key indicators that pressure was building up, leading to a surge of oil and gas. Luckily, unlike in the Gulf of Mexico, the blowout preventer worked. Chairman of the United Kingdom's Parliamentary Energy Committee, Tim Yeo, says the report shows that things could have become as bad as they did in the Gulf of Mexico.
It's not clear that this was something which had been properly prepared for, and it may well have been more luck than judgment that got this under control. We don't want to see people working without the necessary kit, without proper training or procedures, and the result of that being a major spill.
Transocean says it reported the incident to safety authorities, but the revelation is sure to raise new concerns about how to prevent another Deepwater Horizon. In London, I'm the BBC's John Bithrie for Marketplace.
At the climate summit in Cancun, Mexico, there's not much chance of a breakthrough climate change agreement, so negotiators are looking for other things to focus on in their environmental fight. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Scott Tong reports.
John Perry Barlow came to Cancun to network with the business types here. He wants partners and investors for his startup, Algae Systems. It aspires to take sewage, combine it with sunlight, and make fuel. And along the way, take carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. Sci-fi? Actually, they call it biofuel. And Barlow says the world needs fuel.
I'm a great believer in electric cars, but I don't think you're ever going to see an electric airplane. And I don't think you're going to see electric ships, and I don't think you're going to see electric semi-trucks.
He hopes to commercialize his fuel in 3 years. And soon after that, the airlines plan to add plant-based fuel, like his, to their mix. Barlow's taken the climate talks. He basically holds his nose. And he's a sewage guy.
If I want to get depressed, I've got plenty of good ways to do it. Then to watch the world leaders flounder with a dimly perceived notion of their own very particular self-interest trying to solve a global problem.
Truth be told, his product is linked to policy. It could benefit from caps or taxes on fossil fuels. In Cancun, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
We know a lot of metropolitan areas suffered at the hands of the Great Recession, but up to now it's been hard to gauge just to what extent. A new survey by the Brookings Institution highlights 150 of the world's biggest metro areas. This Global Metro Monitor, as it's called, looks at how those areas were doing before and after the economic downturn. Alan Berube is a senior fellow and research director of the Metropolitan Policy Program at Brookings. Welcome to Marketplace.
Hi, Steve. Good to be with you.
What does this examination say about the effects of the Great Recession?
Well, I think it's saying that it's an uneven recession and recovery worldwide when you look at these major metropolitan economies around the globe.
How do American cities fare in these comparisons?
There were a few American cities that really stood out as being among the top performing economies worldwide, places like Las Vegas, Phoenix, Charlotte. We all know what the recession did to some of these places. However, overall, I'd say U.S. cities are rebounding slightly better than their European counterparts.
You mentioned Las Vegas and some of these other Sunbelt cities. What happened in Vegas? Because I noticed it was ranked globally as 14th. And then the Great Recession hit, and it nosedove to 146th out of 150 cities, metro areas that you guys covered.
It's an economy that was really more oriented towards consumption than any other American economy or perhaps any economy worldwide. So it just suggests that given the depth of the recession there, it could be a long and slow road to recovery for that regional economy.
Las Vegas, obviously a huge shift. Do the cities with these big shifts have anything in common?
Well, we saw shifts not unlike what was going on in Vegas in Dublin, Barcelona, Madrid, and some Eastern European capitals, Riga, Latvia, all had a similar sort of asset bubble in the run-up to the recession that when it popped, sent those metropolitan areas really from the top of our rankings to the very bottom.
If I were looking to move to the place today with the most opportunities, anywhere across the globe, where would I go?
You might go to Asia. You might go to places like Shanghai or Mumbai, or you might go to Latin America, cities like Sao Paulo or Lima. Meanwhile, U.S. and European cities are rebounding at very different rates. So I think the rankings may shift quite a bit if we come back 2 years from now and take a look at economic growth at the city level again.
Alan Berube, a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. Alan, thanks.
Great. Thanks very much, Steve.
You're listening to the Midday Update for Tuesday, the 7th day of December. In Los Angeles, I'm Steve Chiotakis.
And in New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson. For the latest look at the markets, you can go to the numbers at marketplace.org.
Consumer Reports has an article out today about how to know if it's time to take the car keys away from an elderly parent. It comes as many states are rethinking the way they test elderly drivers at the DMV. Marketplace's Gregory Warner looks at whether more restrictions could affect the economy.
Most elderly drivers tend to use their cars for errands like grocery shopping, but making it harder for senior citizens to get licenses may not mean fewer shoppers at the drugstore.
By the time you take somebody's license away from them, they've been out spending money every day.
Sandy Rosenblum is a professor at the University of Arizona and an expert on the transportation impacts of an aging society. She says the image of Mr. Magoo driving to the store, clearing out sidewalks along the way, is a myth.
You get to be an unsafe driver not because you're old. You get to be an unsafe driver because you're sick.
For the thousands of Americans who lose their licenses each year, the biggest economic impact might be on their adult children, especially daughters and daughters-in-law, who have to become the taxi of last resort. Anne McCart is with the Insurance Institute for Highway Safety.
Many older people don't live where they have access to other means of transportation.
That's why taking away someone's license, she says, is often the step right before nursing home. In Philadelphia, I'm Gregory Warner for Marketplace.
What's in an area code? Well, those digits can say a lot, actually. Where you are, how long you've been there, if it's a landline or a cell phone number. Steve, what's your area code?
I'm in the 310, Jeremy.
You're in the 3. That's a very popular one. I'm in the king of area codes, the 212.
The 212.
I know we like to think we're the best in New York anyway. But here in New York, we have 5 different area codes, actually, and we're about to get a 6th one. In April, new numbers outside of Manhattan will be assigned the area code 929. Marketplace's Elisa Roth gives us the 411.
There are about 40 million possible phone numbers in the New York City area, and they're starting to run out. It's not that New York's population is growing so fast. There's just more demand for phone numbers. John Manning works for Neustar, which is the company hired by the government to assign area codes.
Years ago, we used to say, well, everybody was getting a second line and they were getting fax numbers. And now it seems like everybody in the family has a wireless telephone number.
The U.S. phone system is based on 7 digits. So the only way to add numbers is to keep adding area codes. Manning says that costs money all around. Phone companies have to reprogram their switches, and it can cost businesses too.
Changing stationery, signage, and things like that, just getting acclimated.
There's an unofficial hierarchy to the current area codes. In New York, 212 is at the top. Newer ones like 347 and 646 are at the bottom. Roger Entner is a telecom analyst at the Nielsen Company. He says the value of an area code may all be in your head, but it does say something.
212, it means you've been in New York a long time, especially if you have a 212 cell phone number, because everybody else has 917.
And individuals aren't the only ones who care. Las Vegas tried, unsuccessfully, to win the lucky area code 777. In Florida, the county around Cape Canaveral did manage to get the area code 321. In area code 212, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
And finally, Steve, to the 617 area code up in Massachusetts.
Mm-hmm.
Well, for the first time since 1650, the governing board at Harvard University is getting a big makeover. This follows a 27% drop in the Harvard endowment last year. And the school's president yesterday said it's time for a change. The board that oversees the finances there will no longer have lifetime appointments.
Ah.
That's been the case since 1650. Now members will serve 6-year terms.
Okay.
One Harvard professor quipped that it makes sense to do it that way because a lifetime appointment back in 1650 was a lot shorter than it is today. Times have changed.
Yes, they have.
In the last 350 years. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Steve Chiotakis in Los Angeles. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.